My name is Zoe, the co-host of Not Superwoman. I am the granddaughter of French, English and Irish immigrants now living on Burrurong land. I acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land in which this podcast was recorded. We pay respects to elders past and present. I recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with this land.
Welcome to this week's episode of Not Superwoman.
Hi, Rat.
Hi, and we're back. And this time tackling a what felt very intimidating topic, but has turned out to be really inspiring. Topic.
And I wanted to just add in there a subject that's never been close to my heart.
Money.
Money and finance.
Finances, budgeting. Yes, it's all those words feel like you get a bit of a shiver down your spine when you say it.
I actually feel kind of nauseous.
We speak with Rebecca Pritchard. She's a senior financial planner at Rising Tide Financial Services. She's incredibly humble because she is an award-winning senior financial planner. And we wanted to sit down with her because this is something that obviously affects all of our lives, especially with the cost of living and the headlines that have been popping up of late, which is, you know, the super splitting between partners and then, you know, the super gap between men and women, that there is a ginormous gap that's being investigated in Australia, $17 billion, that they're trying to understand how the gap has gotten so great. And then you've got a...
called giving birth.
Yes, I mean, that's the reality of it, is it basically is coming down to the fact that caregiving isn't really a quantified role within our financial and societal structure. And then further to that, you know, women are, for the majority share that do have children, end up not returning to full-time roles, and in turn their super is deeply affected.
What I took from it and what I love chatting to Beck about is she was everything I would never imagine someone in finance to be. Like, she's open, honest, you feel comfortable chatting to her. She's really attractive. Yeah. Not that that matters, but she removes every stereotype I've ever thought about finance.
Totally.
And made me motivated to want to take control of my own finances.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, when I was talking to her in advance of the episode, it's so intimidating, finances. And then on top of that, through our interview, I'm really realizing that, like, it is an integral part of your family and your, you know, she says financial health. I'm like, you know, we really have explored in this podcast about your well-being as an individual, then your relationship with your partner, and financial health of your family is the other huge facet that deserves as much time and attention and shouldn't be ignored, because it adds what, you know, Beck talks about. It adds, and she shares a very personal story that you'll hear in the episode, but, you know, it adds tension, it adds stress, it adds emotional layers to your whole family dynamic. And so don't shy away from it. And there are such simple things that you can do from home to not only start raising the conversation with your partner, but also just harnessing your ability to plan and have a contribution and feel in control and validated. And, yeah, it was very uplifting.
She also, another, well, actually took a lot from this episode, and maybe I needed to. The other thing, you know, is language around money with your children. I found that really interesting, the way that she kind of delves into that, and also removing that taboo with, you know, when you're out with your friends, do talk about money, do talk about super finances, things like that. Because, you know, I was in a situation recently where someone really put me on the spot. Granted, I still would never do this and I still didn't feel comfortable with it. But, you know, asked me point blank what I earned and what my hourly rate was. And I was really taken aback and I was like, I'm not having this discussion with you. But I guess in the right circumstances, in the right environment, it is great to have these discussions because we're only learning from them.
Mm. And I think it goes to something, touches on what Beck and I talked about in the lead up to this interview, is that that feeling that you might have felt in that moment where someone questioned you and you are put on the spot for many reasons, but one of the layers to it is, and Beck really sort of champions, is your moral equity. Like, you, a lot in our lives, especially as women, when majority share, we're either in freelance, part-time roles or homemakers, you know, your financial contributions don't necessarily equal or compare to what a full-time working partner can offer. But at the same time, it's important to recognise what your moral equity is and feel confident and structure things in a way in which it gains you a sense of self and self-confidence. And so that then, you know, in those moments where someone might ask you something that's not ideal, but you feel more confident to navigate it. Or from my circumstance, I know, you know, I example in the episode, but I was being questioned about when we were doing our wills and about my contributions financially to from purely an administrative point. And I felt really, really low and like flat. And it had nothing to do with my partner. It had nothing to do with, you know, anyone's fault. It just was, I think the important thing that I took away from it is investigate, look into the setup of your super and your life insurance policies, talk about this stuff with your partner and start from there, because it'll only empower you, grow your sense of self and also help structure ultimately for the whole family.
Agreed.
You're not doing it to be an individual and be selfish and whatever.
Pack your bags and leave. $2,000 super.
You're doing it to for the greater good of everyone involved. So we are looking forward to sharing realizing your financial equity and talking to Rebecca Pritchard with you, and hope you take something from this episode. Welcome to this week's episode of Not Super Woman. We are delighted to be sitting with the very intelligent and clever Rebecca Pritchard, Senior Financial Planner at Rising Tide Financial Services. Welcome. We're so excited and grateful that you'd be willing to sit down with us.
Thank you for having me, ladies.
Beck and I spoke in the lead up to today and doing research on this episode, and I was talking about how when we put up a poll on our Instagram about topics that we should talk about, we had so many replies about finances and financials from women that just wanted to learn and understand and get guidance on. And I think we wanted to do this episode, but then when we were talking about it, it's such a big one. Like, mm-hmm. I was like, how do we tackle this?
Well, how do you navigate something and kind of break it down? So we may need to do it in parts.
Yeah. If Beck is willing to have us, and he's not,
come back. He'll never come back.
Come back. Yeah, but we did sort of start talking about in our chat earlier that you very kindly disclosed to us about how you got into finance and what you sort of may think that was the leading reason why you were fascinated by managing money and finance. And you told me about your upbringing and how it sort of all hit a turning point at the age of 16. Do you mind sort of sharing a bit more about that?
Yeah, and to be fair, I think I was a money nerd before that point. Mum and Dad bought me Monopoly, the PC game, so you could play by yourself, just so I could get my fill of that. But yes, I grew up in a really middle class, middle Australia family, thinking, you know, it was literally the white picket fence and, you know, the two kids and a dog situation. And then one day I got a call from, I think it was one of my aunties, and she was like, parents aren't coming home today. Something's happened. I'll explain when I see you. And essentially my dad, through financial stress, had made some really poor decisions and had been arrested. And from that point, our life took just a huge turn. It came like an absolute slap in the face for my mum. She had no idea that as a family we were in financial distress. And suddenly it was a question of, dad's not coming home, mum, you're in charge of everything. You've got two teenage daughters. They may or may not be going to school the next day. Do we get to keep our house? Like, all of these questions just came down like an absolute ton of bricks. And, you know, my heart is actually even pounding just thinking going back through this in terms of the intensity, like the extreme acute feelings that occurred at that point in time.
I mean, I
bloody just, hell.
I know, I can't even imagine. It would, like, you are 1 minute, you're running to your normal family routine and you've got your roles, and generally what we find in a lot of our friendships and women that we talk to is when you're in like what some may call like a traditional model relationship, you divide and conquer roles.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you merge and mesh between and share, but it sounds like your mum was taking care of the family side, mm-hmm. and your dad was in the business and financial money side.
Yep.
So what did she have to take on? How did the shift change? Did she have to return to work? Like, what?
Yeah, it was a really, as I said, it was a really intense time, and it was first and foremost, it became actually about survival. We were grateful to be surrounded by quite a big and supportive family, and we all determined at the start we still all loved each other and we were going to be supporting each other. You know, I think sometimes it's a vital question to check in on, that
yes.
You go, yep, no, we're doing this together. And so, you know, people were bringing around groceries to make sure that, you know, we were still eating, that my mum didn't have to worry about some of that really basic stuff. But we were dealing with, and I think this is quite applicable for a lot of families, we were dealing with financial stress and mental health stress, quite acute mental health pressures at the same time. So trying to navigate that, there was the added complexity of like a legal component of the conversation that no one had any experience in. And so it was really about putting one foot in front of the other, and making sure it's like, okay, I think in the end, you know, my sister and I had like a day or two off school, and then it was like, all right, back, girls, uniforms on, out the door. And for me, that was my year 10. My dad went to prison the day before my year 10 formal. But mum was working through navigating, going like, yep, you still get a dress, you're still going, you know, this is important for your childhood. But then it's funny, I also remember in the car on the way to my girlfriend's house being like, mum, can you just not talk about this for 5 minutes? And she was like, no, because this is my life and I can't escape it. Like, we're going to the formal, but we're still going to have to deal with the reality of what our life looks like at this point in time.
Yeah, God.
I just can't even, like, so once your dad was charged, what financial position did that leave your mum in? Did she have to take over managing all of that?
Yep, and it was a period of discovery because, like a lot of, she wasn't a housewife, she was working at that point in time, but she had to discover where the money was, what money we had, how yes. bills were paid. And so there was that process. Because there was a criminal component, we weren't sure as a family, like, if our money would be, like, seized. And so that was a really interesting factor. Naive Rebecca, I remember talking to my mum being like, maybe we can like write into a radio station and they'll like take pity on us, and you know, and mum was like, no, we're the bad guys, like we're you know, this has come from wrongdoing and from harm, so like we have to solve this ourselves. So yeah, it was a really a maturing point of my life, but it's formed the foundations of, as someone who had historically loved money, I'm really grateful that I still love money, but I saw and I learnt so much in a very short period of time in terms of the harm that money can bring to a family unit, and that, for want of a better term, like the dark side of it, and what it can do to an individual, to a couple, to a family, if it's not, you know, respected managed. And managed. Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot.
Put so well.
I know, and that's a lot for like a 16-year-old to take on. And I can only imagine, it sounds like from everything that you're saying, it has completely shaped you. Like, not only the emotional maturity that you would be going to school every day with that in the back of your mind, and most likely I can imagine trying to put on like a facade to your friends, but knowing that you've got this weight of responsibility of what your role is in contributing to try and get the family unit back to an even keel, and then on top of that, watching almost like from afar to go, okay, this is how I'm not going to do things going forward. Was that sort of shaping that it had?
Yep, and it was a learning about relationships as well as about money. It was putting a really sharp light on my parents' relationship. My parents are still married. You know,
good.
This is
I love that.
Sort of 20 years down the road.
That is impressive. Like, yeah, no, far out.
They've worked pretty bloody hard on that.
Yeah,
relationships are hard.
Yeah,
talk about a low to, you know, work through together, my goodness.
Yeah, and certainly the learnings of, you know, extended family support networks. You know, we talk often in families about villages and the importance of community. So, you know, there's so many takeaways in that. There's the financial components, there's the relationship components. And at the end of the day, if I'm really blunt as well, like, my parents did an excellent job of shielding my sister and I through it as well. You know, whilst we were there, we still had a reasonably normal childhood apart from that in those late teenage years, and we were still able to, you know, have a lot of, lifestyle, albeit that I racked up my 120 hours of learning to drive, driving to visit my dad instead of great way to do it. Don't recommend, but.
Oh, my gosh, the silver lining of that.
Yeah, you've got
that silver lining.
That is very good.
So it seems like you may have learnt like a harsh lesson here, but what have you taken from that in the way that you manage money now and going forward? Like, what have you learnt, I guess, from all of this?
So I think I like to think that my career would have gone in this direction independently because I have always loved money, but I think I would be naive to say that it hasn't put a layer of passion and seriousness and almost aggressiveness at times in terms of how important it is for couples to manage money. Basic financial health is something that every single person needs. You know, you'll hear me say a million times, every single person needs a financial plan. Not everyone needs a financial planner. But particularly from the couple's dynamic, because in theory, working as a couple, working as a team, everything should be easier. Yes, there's challenges of having, you know, multiple perspectives, but making sure that the financial responsibility in a couple is managed and harnessed so that this situation doesn't need to happen. You know, I've had many, many years of reflecting and looking back, asking questions of myself as a child, an observer of a relationship. And I do fundamentally believe that my parents' situation was entirely avoidable. You know, there is a lot of financial stress that is systemic and structural, and that is harder to shift. But in my case, it could have been, it absolutely should have been avoided.
Yes.
In our conversation prior to this, I do remember you saying that you since have gone back, now that you are educated and an expert in this area, you've gone back and reviewed your dad's financial decisions. And I found that quite fascinating. I was like, what a roller coaster of mixed emotions to be able to go back and do that. And is that how you have formatively been able to come to the conclusion that they could have avoided this?
Yeah, absolutely. And in this case, and in a lot of cases that I do see with some of my clients as well, there is a difference between actual financial stress and perceived financial stress. And, you know, I think we can all think of a moment in our life where we've got into our heads and anxiety has built or spiraled, and the perception of financial stress can be really, really heavy. Sometimes that is considerably more heavy than the actual stress that exists. And this is when you are hiding, shielding, protecting, avoiding, whichever verb or adjective you'd like to use, the situation from your partner. It adds this extra weight.
Like when packages come and you haven't told them.
Yeah, and we can talk about this in the most like banal example of like, where did you pay for that? Or my husband asked me yesterday, he's like, oh, was work paying for that? And I was like, oh. And when the kids started crying, which was a great diversion. But you can see how these things sort of escalate.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I feel like you've been listening.
A web of small online lies.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we tell ourselves are white lies and harmless. I think if you probably layer them on top of each other and then really talk about the fact that you're probably layering on pressure to yourself, you know, deceit in the relationship. And then I think when you said financial health before, it just makes me think about the health component of the relationship. Like if you are lying, deceiving.
For lack of a better word, you're a liar.
Yeah, which is and I'm thinking on the scale of, you know, again, here I'm justifying it, but like white lies of buying shoes or something like that. But
yeah, we're talking about trivial.
Trivial purchases, but at the same time it does add up and it does account for stress and pressure on the relationship that it is even oblivious to even the other partner.
Yeah, and, yes. And what we're talking about as well is in the context of sort of normal operating rhythm in a household or in a family unit. That's before that any stress has been injected into this. And it was a really big motivator for me with my then boyfriend, now husband and the father of my children. It's actually why we started working with a financial planner when we were 22, right? Like that's very young in the scheme of things. Firstly, to have found your partner at that point. But it was something that I was really conscious, like money didn't stress me out. I thought money was fantastic. Like I said, I've had a love affair with it since I was a very young child. But I was really aware of the responsibility. And my husband was like, great, you're into this. Off you go, honey. Go plan our life. And I wanted some support so that in 10 years' time, we didn't look back and go like, why did you make that choice? Or you forgot this, or you didn't do this. Or it was just balancing out that sense of responsibility.
Well, it's a team and a shared burden. Not that it's a burden, but it's you shaping your entire life.
And you know, that expression of you don't know what you don't know. And so making sure that there was another perspective, a fresh set of eyes on this situation, let alone an actual support or expertise if shit hit the fan. But it was going, I don't want to carry this weight myself.
No.
Because I've seen how it can blow up. And this was when we were in a really healthy place. You know, you're 22, you got zero responsibility.
Not a care in the world.
Not a care in the world. It was like, okay, if we can set ourselves up now, like money could be, you know, a real force for good. It can be something that's really positive and it enables our lifestyle. And I was really aware that, my partner was going like, I'm not particularly engaged in this conversation. So that for me was a red flag and saying, let's do something to mitigate that.
I mean, it's a real credit to you to turn such a traumatic experience into such a, like, just turning it around and going, okay, well, this is where, like, you know, I'm 22 and I want a healthy relationship in my personal relationship, but I want a healthy financial relationship within my relationship and for myself. I mean, those, what a, like, for the want of a better term, with all of the trauma that it would have caused by what your parents went through, what a gift that it gave you for your relationship going forward and for your ability to see things from a new light.
Yeah, it is. And look, I am a glass half full kind of person, so I can hold on to all of those positive things. Like 0 out of 10, do not recommend in terms of life lessons to voluntarily impart to your children. But there is a lot that we took out of it. And as I said, my parents did a wonderful job of protecting my sister and I. And so they have had to deal with their own challenges in the last couple of decades, professionally, romantically, financially. But I'm very fortunate that my sister and I were able to start with a relatively clean slate as adults. But I think it did really require some reflection and some deliberation of like, what do I want my relationship to be with money? How do I view my own romantic relationships, my independence, making sure that all of these kind of mesh together nicely and didn't just turn me into a downward spiral.
And we never, you know, I'm just reflecting on this, we never talked about it growing up as a family. It was never something that was really discussed. It was almost seen as taboo, bad mm-hmm. manners, but I think that's changed so much in the last 20 years.
Mm.
And again, you know, we come back to this knowledge is power, discussing things, how other people do it. You know, it only helps each other.
Well, yeah, it definitely ties back to the whole conversation, I think, that we've had about that. I mean, this seems so extreme, but if we're talking on the big picture of the gender equality, like you saw your parents in defined traditional old school roles, and it seems like you had then witnessed that and gone, you know what, I think it's better or healthier to have a crossover of, you know, you wanted to work and you were passionate about work and your partner wants to work and passionate about work and both deal with money together equally. Is that sort of how it unfolded? You went, I'm not going to fall into what was the old school traditional format.
Yep. And seeing money as a force for good, thinking about some of the foundations that sit behind a really good financial setup or financial health, you know, cash buffer. There's the proportion of Australians who are in serious trouble if something goes wrong, like a car breaks down, something breaks in their house, they don't have $1,000 or $5,000 to their name. Like, it scares the living daylights out of me as a financial planner. So good financial basics for that. Like, my husband and I, you know, we had life insurances at 22. So, like, again, I appreciate that's unusual, but it was like, let's build the protective mechanisms around ourselves so that then we can be bold and take risks in other areas. So yeah. I knew if it all went pear-shaped, like, we would only drop so far.
Yes.
Because we had this foundation underneath us.
Yeah. Yes, it's because, I mean, Zoe and I, we've talked about the fact that, I mean, Zoe's a freelancer and I have been for the last 8 years a homemaker. And so when I was talking to you about how to tackle this episode and where it all sort of, where to start, it's so big. But what hit home to me was there's these realities, for example, using my situation, in that we've undertaken the roles, and so Tom manages the finances and I manage the family and our personal lives. What comes with that is when I was reviewing the article that you did in the Australian Financial Review about superannuation and super splitting between partners. And it's an article which I highly recommend everyone reads and we'll put up on our Instagram. But it was talking about how when you are in the care role or when you go to have children and you are out of the workforce for a certain period of time due to childbearing and caring for newborns and so on, and then there is a scary statistic, and I can't think of it off the top of my head, about majority of women, once they've had children, there's a vast majority that don't end up returning to full-time work. So then their earning capacity is limited. And then you add in that because of those reasons, you don't get any top-ups in your super fund because you're not working continuously, that then your super drops down. And you're in this article, you were referring to the fact that you advise clients it's a good opportunity to super split so that then you've got equal value in your super funds, from my very naive...
You're doing great.
But I was talking to about it, I'm like... And one of the things that you highlighted was that a lot of the super funds don't really want to advertise this because it's a lot of administrative work in regards to no gain for them. They don't get any extra money. It's just adding a lot of paperwork and hoopla. And I was talking to you from my position going, yeah, so what in practical terms, it is a lot of paperwork and it is a lot of administration. And if your partner passes away, you're most likely going to be the beneficiary. And then if you get divorced, the courts are going to equalise it most likely anyway. So what's the point? And you posed to me the question of, well, Beck, what's your moral equity? Like, what is your value of contribution? And it was just a stopping moment of going, Oh, I get it. Mm-hmm. And then it made me think about all the moments in which I had experienced, and I think I exampled to you about how I was sitting in a meeting and trying to work out our wills and talking about my super fund and how it's just dwindled to nothing. And it was just so uncomfortable in the room for everyone involved. But it made me realise that feeling that mm-hmm. I had within myself in that moment of, oh, okay, that's where the administration and the paperwork and is valuable, because it's adding financial equity to my contribution to this family. So can you talk to me more about that article and your suggestions in moral equity?
Look, it's a big topic. Everyone grab a coffee. Let's deal with the value of care in this country. So, look, there is a lot of challenges that exist in modern Australia. I think there was a fantastic article actually this morning in the AFR by Georgie Dent, who I'm sure you know, mm-hmm. Talking about the motherhood penalty. And there's a lot of indirect challenges from the magnificent work that women do in terms of conceiving, carrying, birthing and caring for families. What we're talking about here is finding a way to manage the direct penalty, which is I'm not working for a period of time, irrespective of how long that time is. Therefore, I don't get cash in my bank account, which may or may not be an issue if you've got shared bank accounts. But superannuation is something that exists only in your name. So even if you've got shared bank accounts, so you're not seeing the sort of lack of income as obviously, your super, if you're not working, will just plateau, inch forward, or possibly go backwards if you've got fees and insurance premiums coming out of it. So having a really active conversation in this space, to be like, hang on, honey. Can we talk about how we're going to manage this as a family? Because there is a shit ton? That is the technical term. There is a shit ton of indirect challenges to deal with. And then there's not necessarily obvious solutions for how you deal with that. But this direct challenge of saying my super is taking a battering because of this wonderful role that I'm playing in the household, you can do something about that.
Mm.
There's two ways of managing it, which is you put more money into the system. So this would require you and your partner saying, like, we've got some spare cash, let's mm-hmm. top up my super for the period of time that I'm not working. That's lovely. If you can do that, fantastic.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the time when you're starting a family is at the time when your income is the lowest as a household and your expenses are the highest. So the likelihood of you putting in extra cashola is slim.
Unlikely, yeah.
And even if you've got it, you might just simply take a more defensive road of going, let's just hold on to it for a period of time because it feels like there's stuff flying everywhere at the moment. An alternative strategy to that approach is saying, hey, honey, you you know your employer putting contributions into your super fund? Why don't you chop a little bit over this in this direction? And most people don't realise that you can do that in Australia because for the reasons you mentioned, super funds don't advertise it, advisors don't talk about it, people aren't mentioning this over brunch. I would love that to change. I think this is a great brunch topic of conversation. So in that regard, you're not growing the household superannuation, right? Like there's no more money in the system for you and your partner, but you're redistributing it in a way to make sure that you're not financially penalised for taking a back step professionally and financially. This really speaks to the concept of equity and value in your household because it's very easy at the top level to be like, doesn't mean anything, right? Like, does it really matter if it's in my account or your account? And I fundamentally believe that like that is the patriarchy in terms of going like maintain the status quo. Like it's fine, you know, at a household, it's fine. But we know that you are now disengaged with your superannuation. You might feel ashamed or you might be one of the countless women I see who like are laughing when they're telling me about their super, like it's monopoly money because they're so far removed from it. And they're like, like that ship has sailed. Like,
which is alarming.
Yeah, and it's
I can't fix it.
And you're like, oh, it's a defense mechanism. Like, lol, my super's so embarrassing. I have 17 accounts and they've all got $6 in them. So
yes.
it affects our engagement. It affects our feeling of contribution. It affects our value. It affects our feeling of financial security. It may also, you know, if you do end up having a divorce or a relationship breakdown, it may change the way you negotiate in that relationship breakdown. So all of these factors, and they're not easy to point to, they're not easy to quantify, but I think every single woman who is listening to this knows exactly the feeling that we're talking about.
Zoe, you were talking about it in regards to the freelance side of it. I mean, it's always that moment you were saying where you haven't had, because you're freelance, they don't have to pay you, and then, I mean,
well, you're meant to, I guess, have taken it out of your, you're meant to take it out of your weekly
invoicing. Pay yourself.
And kind of take that into account. But usually you don't, because if I'm being realistic here, other things come up that you just prioritise, and that's just not a priority for me at the moment. And I know that Charlie's getting super.
Yep.
And I guess you do think, well, if I put it into my super, I can't get it out.
Mm-hmm.
What if something happens and I need access to it? I don't know. You run through all these different scenarios, and I guess I've never been educated in it. So I've always had a super fund. And I guess when I was working, I've always worked from 16 because, again, loved money, loved working, but never knew the best way to invest it, make it grow, save, or what really super was going to do for me as I got older.
Yeah. And certainly for any freelancers or self-employed people listening here, you know, I would really encourage you to see it as a hygiene factor. The sooner that you get into the rhythm of doing it and seeing it as non-negotiable, you know, I always say we don't wake up this morning and go, I'm not sure if I'm going to brush my teeth today. Like that feels optional. You know, we get up, I mean, showers we talked about, potentially.
That is funny.
That might be optional day to day, but if viewing it as something that is a mandatory part of your hygiene, you know, you, I would imagine, depending on how much you're earning, you would be withholding to pay GST or income tax. And so seeing it in the same degree of seriousness and just take, wherever possible, take the choice out of it. Stop making it so you have to make a decision every day, because of course, like, you know, you get that decision fatigue, you get distracted. There's a million things in our life that will be screaming for money at any given point in time, from like, you know, purely discretionary things to other very important things. So seeing it as a hygiene factor and just, brush your teeth, change your knickers, have a shower.
Yeah.
So just to put context, we were talking about the fact that we're doing a Zoom interview the other day and I ran out of time to shower. And I thought it was fine because I'm on Zoom, but I didn't think about what I was going to look like in the clips. But anyway, we've learned and include that in the hygiene of day to day. And that's such a good description.
When you're starting a business, and again, like you often business owners are trying to reinvest in themselves, reinvest in the business. So I get that in terms of like foundation levels. And sometimes that can be the best thing you can do for your money. But then that's when you look at your partner, if you've got one, going, can we rebalance the scales? Because me investing over here, that's still going to be beneficial for our household. As we go, can we make sure that things are relatively even? So this could be applied for building a business. It could be applied for caring and family responsibilities. It could be, I'm going to work part-time for a few years while I study. And again, that's going to be an investment for our household. So viewing this as a holistic and a collective thing, and whilst primarily we're talking here from a gender perspective, from, you know, man splitting across to a woman, but it absolutely can go in the other direction,
yeah,
as well.
Yes, totally. And it's funny because two things come to my mind. It's short-term pain, long-term gain. You're removing it from your pocket now, but it's only because you are adding value to your future as a family collective, as you said it. I think the hygiene description of, you know, it's in the same thinking of it in the same vein as like as important as brushing your teeth each day or showering. But then the other thing is it comes down to the question I have is like, I guess it's also reviewing your structure of the way you'll do money management anyway, so that then it depends, like you talked earlier about how integral it is when you sit down with clients about having a cash buffer, so that if your car breaks down, you've got a cash buffer there. Like, yes, so don't do it to the point where don't do it to the point where you've chewed into your cash buffer and your car's broken down but it's now in your super and you haven't structured it properly. Is it reviewing the structure with your partner and ideally a financial planner?
And it's about balance, right? It's never, and you can apply this to your fitness, you know, the things that you eat, your career, any of these. It's the same language, it's just a different application. You know, you want sustainability, you want balance. So, you know, we're never saying like, oh, you must pay for all of these fabulous insurance, but you have nothing in the bank. Or you have this fabulous bank account, but then you've got nothing in your superannuation account and you're in trouble in 20 years time. It's probably a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Just don't worry about getting any one area perfect. If you can kind of move it all forward.
Yes.
You know, something is better than nothing.
Oh, 100%. So when you're meeting with clients, mm-hmm. what would your biggest red flags be that women come in with when they're talking to you? Like what makes you think, okay, this needs to change and this is their problems they're presenting you with?
Yeah, fortunately I work with some pretty kick-ass women, mm-hmm. and even if they don't know some of this stuff historically, they're motivated to learn and to change the narrative going forward.
Yeah.
The biggest red flag is actually when they are with a partner who doesn't want to participate in the conversation or doesn't want to share information. Which for me, I really want to bring that conversation to a head as soon as possible because it's also a red flag for a whole lot of other reasons. Mm. So for example, you know, if you talk about, say, super splitting with your partner early in the piece, ideally even before you've had children, if your partner is saying, no, I don't like that idea, I don't value that contribution that you might be making to the family, like bring that to a head as soon as possible because it's going to cause an issue in this area, but I can guarantee it's going to cause an issue in so many other areas of your relationship. So some of, you know, the brilliance here and some of the challenges here, it does transfer across so many different areas. My husband did try and tell me that he was like, do I have to transfer you some of my super? And I was like, yes. Otherwise, we talked about naming rights of our baby and I was like, this baby is not getting your name if you don't sign this paperwork.
Sometimes it does take a bit of coercion.
I'm a big fan of the phrase spirited debate.
Yeah.
And put it on the table. Yeah.
Yeah, so true. Because I think the other thing I was thinking before, outside of the practical terms, you're going back to the emotional side of it, is it's got such a great impact when you are, say, for example, with Zoe, if she's freelancing and she's done one job, she might have an income come in, and then there's, I know with wedding season particularly, like there's a lull. And so then, you know, not as many weddings.
Well, you need to learn how to budget mm-hmm. the whole year.
Feast and famine.
Yes. And so, but that influx of how, I know we've had conversations where you're like, oh God, it's such a trying time. The emotional layer there of, you know, how you're feeling about your contribution and what's coming in. And, you know, then for me on my side of it is how that feeling I have, which it happens outside of, you know, accounts and business meetings. But like when I was sitting in that office and it was just like, oh, I just feel pathetic because our society is based on a structure where if you are financially successful, it's a measure of overarching success. And then if you are not contributing a dollar value, then it really does eat away at your sense of self and your self-worth because no one else can see by dollar value, your net worth, you know?
And we see this professionally come about actually in the underinsurance of women. Again, like you can apply this across Australia. So historically, women in terms of life insurance or total and permanent disability cover are substantially underinsured. And that is for those reasons that you say. It's like, I'm the breadwinner. I'm going to have a whopping big life insurance because we've got a mortgage and three kids. But this other person in our family who actually is generating economic value because they are doing things that would be expensive to replace if needed has like $6 of life insurance or nothing. And families don't see that as a valuable investment. So even participating in that conversation, like looking up your super, do you have any insurances in there? Having a conversation with your partner, being like, hey, if I fall off the perch, what would you do? And so often families still need to be getting some substantial life insurances for homemakers or those on home duties to reflect that the value is you actually can quantify it in a lot of ways. Mm. We talked earlier about replacement value. And if a homemaker wasn't in the home doing that, it would be expensive. It would be more expensive to hire somebody to play that role.
To play those, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars I'm worth.
Well, if you think about it also relative to the age of your children, Zoe, it's a really good way of factoring it in because as your kids get older, your risk actually should go down, right? Because they're less dependent on you. They've got less years in front of them until they reach adulthood. You know, when you've got a baby or young children, that's your peak risk, right? Because you've got to support these humans for a number of years. Mm. And so it's not even about what you earn or what your replacement value would be today. It's also extrapolating that out over the years to come until your children reach adulthood.
Yeah, and it's funny because as we're talking to you, I hear it in a way of not going home and talking to your partner like guns blazing, being like, "I'm worth a fortune." Like, I don't know if that would be go down, but more to the point of starting those conversations just before you exampled, investigate if you've got insurance in your super. And then, you know, discussing what your partner would do if you were to fall sick or fall off the perch. I mean, those realities would then prompt that conversation mm-hmm. of, okay, yes, I see we need to plan for this, this and this. And I think, again, it's a collective conversation together that then would also help to the point of reviewing both your roles and both of your contributions and trying to figure out an equal measure. Mm. Because I find when I talk to my husband about it, he is so more than willing to listen. I think what he finds challenging is like when I try and explain, oh, you know, having a $0 value does deteriorate your sense of self-worth.
And he's like, but you, the kids love you and you do such an amazing, and, you know, and you're so, and he like sincerely means it and believes it. But I'm like, but society's not structured that mm-hmm. way. I appreciate that you think that of me, but we're talking about in the big picture of yep. life and admin. But and
please transfer me half your super.
Yes. And if you take.
And I'd just, like some too.
Yes, please. Divvy it all around. Fun fact, you can't split just any old random. It does need to be to your spouse. But in these two specific examples, like super and insurance, like having a conversation about life insurance is fundamentally going to be to your partner's benefit, because they're the ones that are going to be in trouble if you are underinsured and something happens to you. Mm. If your partner's insured and you're not, if they kick it, like I'm sure you'll be very sad, but you will be okay.
Yes.
They're actually at risk from your underinsurance. From a super perspective, apart from my grumpy old husband, actually almost every single man that I've had this conversation with is thrilled that there is a mechanism that exists that they can show financial value to their partner. And they're like, oh, I just have to sign this form once a year. That's fantastic, because they're awkward about it. Mm. They're aware of it. Yeah. They know it exists. They don't like it. But as far as they're aware, until you bring this to their attention, they're like, oh, it's the way it is.
Well, they don't know.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. So everyone is actually really open-minded in my experience of being mm-hmm. like, fantastic. Like yeah. they're just leaping at it.
So how do you feel about the Australian government announcing super unpaid parental leave?
That's a good question, Zoe. I have very deep feelings about this. So, look, it's a step in the right direction, right? It absolutely is. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it's going to be one of those things that, you know, in the same way we look back at our parents and be like, what do you mean you thought smoking was a good idea? Our kids are going to be like, what do you mean this didn't exist? It's so obvious. Go for it.
Well, it just should have always been.
Yeah, it should have always been the case. Like, I can't believe we're still talking about it.
No.
In terms of it being heralded as a way to close the gender super gap for women, like that is so far removed from reality. You know, if you take, you know, across paid parental leave, if a woman in her, like say the age of 30, 32, takes full paid parental leave, we're talking about adding like 50 grand to her super in future values at the age of 65. That is, it doesn't do anything to account for that gap in earnings, the gap in contributions to super through a period of not working or part-time
yeah.
leave. And you compound that over 20 or 30 years. So this is fantastic, but like let's move the conversation along, because there's a much bigger fish to fry in this space. Starting with something like super splitting, starting with super funds, advertising it, making their members aware of it, making the forms easy to access. There's a lot to be done in this space. Making childcare universal and accessible. We've put a nice little band-aid on here, so let's keep moving.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to go to the Future Women's Summit, and you did. I ironically then was talking to Beck about it, and she was like, "Oh, I was a founding member," which is brilliant. But through there, there's some stats that I was learning. Like, there's 23% less super. Women have 23% less superannuation than men, and at the moment, that averages about a $17 billion gap. And then with the gender pay gap at the moment, in an average full-time position, for every dollar a man earns, a woman earns 88 cents. So you can see how, I mean, the gap is huge, growing and existent. And then you were talking about a approximate number at a conference in regards to care as well, that there trillions, the value of unpaid care enters into the trillions.
Yep, I can't remember the exact stats, but it was certainly that if the caring economy or the value of unpaid care in Australia was quantified, it would be like our second or third biggest industry in Australia, yeah. behind like mining or resources and financials. Like it's an absolute whopper.
Well, it's such an undervalued part of our society, yep. that And everybody works in some capacity.
Yeah, like, and you can see it in so many different areas, Zoe. You can see it in the fact that, you know, nursing, aged care, childcare, these are low-paid industries but are fundamental, they're crucial for our ability to meet productivity targets or anything in terms of that economic regard. So there's so much to be done here. But I'm, in terms of a super unpaid parental leave, I'm so happy that we're ticking that box, because now we can use collective brain power, we can use lobbying to tackle the next bit.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, gosh, we've just sort of touched on, that was one of my next questions was, as a society, how do we start trying to change the value of care? But really, I just feel like let's start at the base level of things that we can do as individuals from home to take care and vocalise and voice and champion change within our household, which then as a collective community can, start the process of making noise and shifting it in a different direction. So, what would be your top three tips in, reviewing things from home?
Yep. So, look in the mirror is certainly part of this. Going, we're not expecting your listeners to go have big policy impact or run as a senator or something like that. go for it if that's your jam.
That's your passion.
Look at home is certainly the first step. So we've talked a lot about superannuation and insurances already. The third one, the big final prong of that, is cash flow. It's a thing that, we see and we feel on a day-to-day basis. It's a thing that hurts us now if it's not functioning. It's the thing that blew up in my family all of those years ago, is having cash available in the right place at the right time. And the reality is, irrespective if you're in a paid role or an unpaid role, women overarchingly do run household systems. So we are in a prime position to manage, imagine if this was actually taught in home ec instead of how to make falafel.
It needs to be a subject at school.
Home economics, what a misleading subject.
Learn how to do your tax return. Navigate Centrelink.
Yep. Seriously. Ins and outs. So if you break this down into, if you're showing an interest and you want to know how your household, what sort of position your household health is in, two things you want to work out is what do you own and what do you owe? So your assets relative to your debts, write them down. I don't care if it's in grey lead, if it's on a post-it, if it's, on a Pinterest board, I don't care what format gets you going, work with what you've got. And the second is what money is coming in and what is going out. So how much do you earn and how much do you spend as a household? Always start with where you are. Don't think about what you want to be doing, what you think you should be doing, what you think you need to be doing. Start with where you are and go from there.
Mm, that's such good advice. And then book in an appointment with you.
Happy to chat.
And then cry.
No.
Pour yourself a large glass of bread.
So many people, Zoe, come in the door and they're like, I don't know if I've just got this big bad wolf persona. Everyone's coming in and they're like, I think I'm going to smack them or something, or yell at them. I don't think I've ever yelled at a client in my life. And
that is actually true. I know that's awful, but you do. Then when I met, I actually thought I was a bit nervous. But I'm like, Beck walks and you're like, Beck's really gorgeous and glamorous and beautiful. And she makes finance seem fun.
Yes.
Well, the best part about finance and why I'm so motivated by it is, you don't have to be an expert in the money side of things, but you are, each of you individually, you are an expert in your life. You understand how you like to live. You understand what's important to you and your family. The money stuff, it kind of back solves from there. So if you focus in why it's important to you, what your goals are, what your values are, particularly when kids come along, there's a degree of seriousness that steps up at that point, because you're like, oh shit, I'm responsible for somebody else. Yeah, it's not just on me. And so use those motivations and focus in the why you're doing it. It's never about I just want to make more money. We're never talking about saving because it's fun or investing because it's...
No, it's because you want to do something or be somewhere in your life for the purpose of living and enjoying, mm-hmm. or
Yep. And the, you know, some people like myself included, like are really analytically minded and love coming back to that data side of things. And I'm constantly picking myself up and slapping myself around being like, that's not where you focus on. You've got to just pull yourself back to the whys, and that will keep you on track, and it'll get you through the manky conversation in the lawyer's office talking about what happens if you die. It'll get you through, you know, insurance conversations or learning about investing. You know, you've got to build that connection with it. But, you know, rather than talking about or telling yourself, I'm not good with money or I don't like money or so-and-so does that, it's like, but I am the expert in my life.
Of my life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's such good advice. My last question to you is, we talked about how there's a lot of work to do as a society and looking at especially the sort of gender pay gap and the role of carers and so on. I mean, what do you hope evolves in our systems and structures in the financial world going forward for the sake of your children's future? Mm.
I'd like to think that a lot of the change that has already happened in the last 10 or 15 years, it just simply takes time to wash through some of it. You know, you think about some of the conversations that kids are having, the way that they understand their feelings and that they can articulate things. I think there is a degree of it that will wash through. But from a personal responsibility thing, I think coming back to what you talk about at home, you know, not just being like money doesn't grow on trees, Beck, like that's not a good enough conversation to have with your family. And whether you grew up in a household that talked about money in a really healthy way, or you grew up in a household that didn't talk about money, or you grew up in a household that was really stressed with money, like use whichever motivation is relevant to you, but try and be open about it. You know, if you think about the way we talk about healthy foods these days, why can't we talk about healthy money?
So
hang on, just on that, what language would you use with your children at home around money?
So my kids are nearly 3 and 4, and we've been talking about money since before they could talk. And it's something that I'm really motivated and excited about. And I'm also experimenting, right, as we go, like see what they're interested in. And, you know, at a basic level, we're talking about like mum goes to work to earn an income. Also on Fridays when mum is in her unpaid job today, but mum's working really hard looking after you two rat bags. You know, at a really junior level, we're talking about that toy costs X. You can't take it off the shelf. Like it ain't free, honey. My son can, you know, read numbers now. So we go to the shops and I'm like, okay, you can spend this amount. You spend $20 on something. And he knows that bloody Lego Jurassic Park thing is like $7,000. And it's like, no, those numbers do not add up. And then building that, you know, it's got to be age appropriate, but building on that year after year in terms of whether it's doing things around the house and getting pocket money, it's having savings, whether it's a piggy bank or a digital version of that, getting into the conversation around investing as the years go on. Like sort of, I believe in talking about it in a really relaxed and as you go kind of way. And I think fundamentally, if we can all, whether it's as friends, as partners, as families, just kind of talk about it with less seriousness, it's not like, once a year we sit down and we talk about money.
Yeah. And,
like, that's terrifying. And that's putting much pressure on that conversation. Like, my goodness, nothing good is going to come from that conversation. Like, of course.
Like when Charlie thought Mecca was like a special gym, and I was like, yeah, it's kind of a gym.
Mecca, your face.
He thought it was like holistic. And I'm like, yeah, it's actually a makeup department store.
But if you apply this to, like, imagine if you talk to your kids about like once a year, like, all right, kids, we're going to talk about the importance of exercise or like sex or money.
Oh, you're
it's
making
like,
me nervous.
Oh, my gosh. Like, it sends the cortisol levels right up, right? Yeah. Like, but if you can slip that stuff into conversation here and there, it's less frightening, it's less threatening, it's normal. You know, encouraging asking questions, acknowledging when you don't know the answer. All of these things form form part of a good conversation. Also, if your kids ask you a question about money that you can't answer, that's probably a good indicator.
Red flag.
I know, maybe need to do a bit of Googling on that one.
No, that is just all such wonderful, wonderful advice. And I just think that there's so much you can do from home that is not going to be scary, that's not going to cost you anything. And it's just investing time into the health of your finances, mm-hmm. and which in turn then lends into the health of your relationship and the health of your family, because mm-hmm. all of those conversations are only going to benefit everyone in the whole entire family, but also benefit you in empowering that thought process, the administration and the planning that can go into growing what you need as an individual that it'll ultimately be for the greater good of the family too.
Absolutely. You know, I used to joke with my husband, he earns more than me, but I would say like the economic contribution I make to the family of rallying the resources and getting shit together, you know, like good luck trying to argue that you add more financial value.
Yeah.
But also for everyone listening, you know, think about how you like to take on board information. Like you're listening to a podcast right now. So if that is your jam, you know, there is 10 wonderful financial podcasts that you could listen to and find the one that you like. Sometimes you're like, oh, that person's too nasal, or I don't like their jokes, or whatever. Yeah. There is something that will exist for you if podcasts are your vibe. Same with books. There's like a new book that comes out each month and they're similar, but they're just different styles. Mm. So if you like videos, like go for that. There will be a medium that works for you, and there's financial literacy and education and entertainment in whichever medium is best suited for you.
That's brilliant. And we're going to work with Beck in collating some of your preferred favourites, particularly on this topic for women and for families. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much for today and inspiring us instead of intimidating us about finances.
Well, may I ask you a question for both of you?
Yes.
No, I'm scared.
What? I mean, we've covered a fair bit of ground today, but like what is the thing that you will take from here?
I think the biggest things are starting the investigative work for me in understanding my position of the systems that I've already got in place, like the super that I already have, and I do have a life insurance policy, and understanding those to then take that to my partner and further that conversation. Also bringing it to the like up more regularly and consistently in a non-intimidating way with the kids, and just getting them to be conscious, because it's also going to help with me being more conscious and taking some responsibility as well. So I found that so helpful.
I love that.
Zoe, your turn.
Yeah, I'm just pondering now. Okay, I'm definitely going to call my super fund, because I do have everything set up. I'm quite organized with that. But it's taking that next step and combining our supers, because I've kind of got it all there. I just haven't had the push to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And life insurance, I haven't got it. Charlie does and I haven't. And it's been something we've been discussing. But again, I just keep pushing it back, and it's just getting organized and doing it. So then again, it's done. I don't have to think about it.
Well, it's part of the hygiene, mm-hmm. as you put it.
Brush your teeth. That's all I'm saying. Just brush your teeth.
Yeah. So I think that'll make me feel happier about life.
Yeah, I'm with you, and we are so grateful for your time and expertise, and for just being, as I said, not intimidating and making it a very inspiring conversation. So thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks, Beck.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Not Super Woman. You can find extra resources, links and information on our website, which is notsuper-woman.com.
Is that a dash or a hyphen?
A dash is a hyphen, Rash.
Wonderful.
And if you're enjoying what we're bringing, you can follow us on our socials, and we're across all podcast platforms. So hit subscribe, guys.